Chapter 24. Solstice 2012 on the Two Earths. A Tale of Seven Soldiers. As midnight approached, the 14 great lenses ranged around Two Moon Earth shimmered darkly. There was nobody to see, though, but for a scattering of Seraph soldiers and gangs of wanderers lined up, waiting to conduct their new masters into the cities that still stood, and out into the flats of the new lands, where enormous shanty towns were still under feverish construction, amid heaps of dead sea creatures and dead wanderers. "Dad!" He stopped, came back to the world of his office, turned to Nick, tried not to shout at him, which was what he wanted to do, to tell him to just shut up. "Dad, you need to focus on Martin and Trevor." "Sorry." "Don't be sorry, just do it." His fingers shot back to the keys, began flying. Downstairs, little Kelsey also ranged across the night of the other world, looking for Winnie. Lindy, Brooke had found. She was on a truck that was running down to Denver, which was intended to become a major resettlement area for the corporation's starving billions. There, her destiny would be simple. Like all wanderers, she was to be worked to death. On the sunlit side of the Earth, the gigantic flats that had replaced much of the mid-Pacific were covered by an impenetrable fog as trillions of tons of gases boiled up out of the drying soil. Where India and China had been was a new ocean, stormy and unsettled, floating with what appeared to be islands that were actually made of furniture and ice chests, and logs and carpeting and toys and siding and plastic doors, flower pots, styrofoam cups, shipping beads, any container that was closed and would float, and on these islands were rolling hills of the corpses of cattle and dogs and monkeys and all manner of beast, and human corpses with pale glazed eyes, and swarming masses of gulls and crows, and hordes of pelicans flying from place to place, their craws bulging. They all saw this, the Dale family, in their new free minds, and as she watched, Kelsey sang softly to Barish, whom she cradled as if he was the whole world. She sang the ancient lullaby her mother had taught her, Doreen Day, that had come up from the quiet hearths of the Union and into the quiet hearths of Ireland a very long time ago, a song shared between angels and men. Her voice came up the stairs from the lonely pool of light where she sat carrying in her arms not only Barish, but all the dead of a whole world. She hummed to them and sang in her little voice, Doreen Day, the nightjar calls upon the heath. Outside, night swept on, and the evening star shone on the peaceful horizon. She had been sending her mind down the roads of the other earth for a long time, had this very private child called Kelsey, for she shared with Winnie the same bond that her brother did with Trevor. So she sang not only to her Barish, but to Winnie's, whom she had found in a cradle of snow, the night flakes whispering along his fur, as they whispered across all the little corner of Nebraska where Winnie had given everything she had to give and laid down. Now, as Kelsey sang to Barish and Winnie's Barish, she sang also to Winnie, to the silver of the ice that crusted her cheeks, and her red car coat that was being worried by the winter wind, and to all the little lumps in the ocean of little lumps that were left everywhere on earth that wanderers had passed, each one somebody whose strength had not been enough to meet the corporation's cruel test. Survival of the fittest, the corporation's way, was not the way of the true of heart, human or not. In the office, Nick, and now Brooke along with him, struggled to get Wiley to concentrate on the place that counted, the soul prison where Martin and Trevor and their few struggled for the life of their world. The souls, Brooke whispered. Can you see? Wiley sighed like a weaver does working on a difficult knot. The only sound in the house was Kelsey's singing coming up from below. Okay, he said. He began to type again. But he saw the lens that stood in the ruin of the Giza Plateau. It glowed angry red now, and red light leaped out of it, a huge column that reflected off the shattered city and the desert, making it appear as if the whole landscape was on Mars. With it came a sound, at first a crackling, like the rattling of a great curtain, and then another sound, a snap, then another, louder one, and the lens seemed to shimmer, to shudder within itself. And Seraph were suddenly walking away from it, each carrying a little bundle or a suitcase, some carrying briefcases or rolling bags, some in black, some like hurrying officials in hats and coats, some carrying their babies or baskets of eggs or with their children's hands in theirs. They came clutching receipts for the tickets they had bought and began to stream out past the Mena Hotel toward Cairo and up and down the banks of the Nile. Another sound came then, the gigantic spitting noise a volcano makes when it vomits lava. Some of the colonists turned. Others kept on, intent on getting to whatever corner of the new lands they had bought. Already some were boarding buses that had been smashed in the explosion of the pyramid and trying to get them started, while others threw out the skeletons of the tourists who had died there and marveled over their delicate, colorful clothes. With a roar so huge that it would, over the next few hours, echo around the entire world, a massive red column of material shot out of the hole where the lens had been. The lens itself arced into the stratosphere, turning over and over, and as it turned, changing shape, twisting and melting, and then falling and becoming black, then blacker still, and landing in the Arabian desert not far from Mecca, a city of corpses of those who had died praying, surrounded by a desert coated with wanderers who had fallen beneath the sun. None saw it strike. But Wiley and Brooke did, and Nick, and so also Trevor and Martin. Deep in their traps, the souls of Lindy and Winnie sensed some signal from the outside, and for the first time since she had been pulled from her body, Lindy realized that she was not buried alive in a coffin, hideously and inexplicably unable to die. She began to call the name of the strongest and most trusted person she knew. "I hear my wife," Martin said. "Lindy is calling me." At the same time, though, diamonds began to appear in the air, shimmering black, as Samson prepared to move the souls that would make him rich in Abaddon. Winnie, who had been alone and cold and feeling drawn to some great joy she could not reach, now felt herself in the arms of her friend Kelsey, and heard a lullaby her mom had sung her every night of her life. "The nightjar's calling upon the heath," and rested in the knowledge that somebody was at last saving her from the monsters who had bound her here. In Mecca, a new black stone now lay not far from the Al-Hajar al-Aswad, and of the same material and the same shape and color, for the last one that fell here had started from exactly the same place 13,000 years ago, as Abaddon failed in its last attempt to steal the human worlds, and the raw hole it had left had been filled, and the pyramid built to close the wound and remain as a warning, one that Abaddon had spent 13 millennia tricking and deceiving mankind into forgetting. The rest of the material that had blasted like lava from the huge gateway came to the top of its trajectory and began sailing back down. Far below, the Seraph began to see arms and legs of their own kind, torsos, heads, shoes falling around them, striking one and then another of them, and causing their yellow brains to splash out. Heads bounded along like great hailstones, or rocks catapulted down by a siege army. As they bent to protect children or possessions or eggs, they were smashed. They were all smashed in a maelstrom of destruction from above that seemed never to end, a storm made of body parts. A roar of terror and woe rose up from their throats but was quickly buried in the wet thudding as the living seraph disappeared beneath the mountains of their own dead. Brooke lay her hand over Wiley's for a moment. He glanced up at her, and in that glance they shared exultation. Perhaps also sorrow at the suffering that was being experienced, but it was nothing compared to the rage of battle that was breaking out in the lands of the corporation, gnashing so intense that it was shaking even the pearly walls that enclosed the Union and rustling the leaves in the peaceful lands they protected. They were being torn apart, the minions of Echidna, who had ruled for so long. Wiley looked for Samson, but did not see him. He wanted to identify him, because Samson, who knew human customs and understood gateways, was not defeated until he was destroyed. "They need us," Nick said from behind closed eyes. "They need us now, Dad." "I can't help where the story goes." Nick pushed his father away from the laptop. "Hey! Dad, it's another deception. They're fascinating you with their own destruction, so you won't go where you're needed." He began to type, and when Wiley tried to stop him, Brooke intervened with a sharp shake of her head. Nick's eyes closed. His fingers flew. Before him was a huge room. It was lit by faint blue light that dwindled in the massive space to a blue haze on the distance. The haze flickered slightly, and then he saw why. It was coming from millions upon millions of lozenge-shaped tubes, each emplaced in a socket that was connected to thick black cables that ran between the hundreds and hundreds of rows. Martin was quite familiar with the large cartouches that were depicted on the walls of the Temple of Hathor in the Dendera complex. He had not dated this temple, but he had known since he'd read of Al North's ordeal that the accepted explanation for the oblong cartouches, that they were simply borders meant to enclose hieroglyphics, was not correct. In each one, a multicolored light flickered along a copper filament. It twisted and turned, flying now against the glass of the tube, now twisting itself around the filament, now flashing in a million colors. The light was souls, and he understood now what Abaddon's ages-long propaganda had done to us. It had made us forget the science of the soul, so that we would be helpless when the three Earths again crossed the plane of the galaxy, and they would have their chance, this chance, to return. It had made us forget what these tubes were, which were soul prisons. It had given us generations of scientists who considered the soul a supernatural idea, and so stayed away from any study of it. But there was no supernatural. There were only phenomena that had been understood, quantified, and measured, and phenomena that had not. That the patterns induced in fields of electrons by changing conditions in a body would persist after death and become a sort of plasma, conscious and richly aware of its memories, had never been imagined. It had been assumed, if it was thought about at all, that any electromagnetic activity in the nervous system simply ceased when the body died. And so Martin's Earth had been defenseless when the Seraph returned, as ours will be also on the inevitable day when in their greedy, starved fury they come bursting in on us in whatever cunning new way they may devise. Above the ocean of Samson's soul traps, the long lines of gateways were sparking and shimmering. It would only be moments before it was too late. The souls, seeming to sense this, flickered frantically in their prisons. There came from along the narrow path between two rows of soul traps a clanging. It was young Mike in the gloom, hammering at one of the tubes with a rock he had found on the way in. The sound echoed up and down the great space, rising in intensity until it was the ringing of a great bell, then falling again as he grew tired, finally stopping. Trevor said, "I think there's a seam here." He was down between two rows, where the tubes were connected to the sockets that held them. "What's next, Dad?" Nick asked his father. "You're the writer now, son." "They're running out of time." "And you're frozen." "It happens." "Dad, pick it up." "I can't pick it up. It's yours now." Nick sat. Nothing happened. Wiley waited. His mind remained blank. Brooke said, "What about Al North?" That did it. Nick's fingers began to type. Al North had done wrong and been wrong, but he had never wavered from his duty as he understood it. He knew where his fault lay and what it would inevitably do to him, but also, as long as he had consciousness in him, he would strive to right the wrongs he had created. Even so, those wrongs had led to a horrible catastrophe and billions of deaths, and no small act of heroism could rectify such a tremendous mistake. He could no longer reach the surface of the earth, but this desperate place was far beneath it, and here he could still maneuver. "Look!" Martin pointed to what appeared to be a star in the vault of the space. At that same instant, something rushed past beneath his feet. He looked down in time to see scales, iridescent purple in the blue light, but then the thing was gone. An instant later, Mike screamed as coils surged up around him. Al North saw all this with the clarity and, indeed, the peace of somebody who had accepted his life in full and was prepared to pay the debt he had incurred. He understood the secret of hell, that souls who go there forfeit their right to be. They no longer have a place in this universe or any universe, not until time ends and a new idea comes to replace the one that is the present creation. And then, maybe. He who had done evil accepted the rightness of this. Still, he wanted to repair what he could, and there was something he could do here. They had all forgotten, in their terror, to just let themselves happen, to trust the grace that was immediately and always ready to support them. He forgave them. He hoped for them. Which was a very great thing, that he could surmount his anger and his disappointment and his arrogance long enough to do that one tiny thing, to feel hope. It seemed small, but the energy of such an act on the part of a lost soul is huge, and the tiny spark of goodness that was still within him was easily enough to open 10 million soul traps in one flashing electric instant. A roar of voices burst out. The faint blue light became a million times brighter. Memories, thoughts, pleas, cries of relief, a huge gushing roar of human surprise and joy flew at Martin and his little band in the form of pictures of happy moments, loving in the covers, running by the sea, leaves whirling in autumn, Christmas tree lights, girls dancing, men in blue water, hamburgers, the faces of happy dogs, and song in a million verses of hallelujah. In this mass, 1,000 great serpents came screaming up from the depths of the place and down from the shuddering gateways, their bodies burning from the goodness around them that they could not bear, and they flew into the air like great pillars of fire, writhing and screaming in the sea of song. They were another design, like the Outriders and the Nighthawks, especially fashioned to terrify human beings, but they had been unleashed too late to save Samson's wealth. No doubt, the huge snakes were a rental, and he hadn't wanted to spend the money unless he had to. The song ended. The hot bones of the serpents tumbled down through the ruined masses of shattered tubes. The gateways shimmered and went out. Samson's enormous cry of rage echoed, faded, and died away. He dropped to a stool in his simple room, his narrow head bowed. Outside, the city roared. Another revolution, another aristocracy burned, and now this, his fortune lost. So it went, in the unsettled misery of this age. Unnoticed by the raging crowds, the hour of midnight had passed. The week had won the day. With a quick swipe of his hand across his face, Samson shifted into his human form. Outside, torches flared, feet pounded on the stairs, fists pounded on his door. He stepped through his quickly closing gateway, but not into his old world, not into Martin's world. He had a plan. If there was vengeance to be tasted, he intended to drink deep. "Dad, he's in our woods." They got their shotguns and took off after him, both of them, and Brooke and Kelsey agreed that they'd gone mad. The woods, though, were empty. From along the ridge above the house they could see the lights of Harrow. Faintly, one of the church bells sounded. Snow was falling, whispering in the woods, drawing pale lines along the dark branches of the winter trees. The peace here was so deep that it seemed impossible that Samson could have passed this way. They went back to the house, the two of them. They lingered on the deck. "The belt of Orion," Wiley said, gazing up as the snow clouds made a window for the stars. "And his bow," Nick said, pointing.
"You did good, Nick."
"Thanks, Dad."
"Dad?"
"Yes?"
"Is it real, the book?"
"I thought Samson was in our woods, but he wasn't."
They went inside then and made a fire for the girls. Popcorn was popped and hot chocolate produced, and Wiley even managed to slip a goodly shot of whiskey into his. They spent the remainder of this quiet night speaking of the things of ordinary life.
"Past midnight," Nick said. "I think we won."
Nothing more was said, and after a time, Nick played cards with Kelsey and Wiley, and Brooke broke out the celebration cognac, a 100-year-old bottle that was sipped at moments of victory. Tomorrow, Christmas vacation began for the kids, and in the very late hours, Wiley went into his wife's arms for what felt like the first time in an age. At breakfast, the radio said,
"The world ended last night, but it seems that nobody noticed. New Age gurus from China to Scotland stood on mountaintops and chanted, but guess what? Chicken Little stayed home. We are now living on the first day beyond the end of the ancient Mayan calendar, a date that has no number in their measurement. But then again, they went extinct a long time ago."
Later in the morning, Nick found boot prints back in the woods, where Samson's gateway had been.
"Could have been left by us," Wiley told him.
"I was wearing sneakers when we came out here. You had on a sock. One sock."
"I went out in the woods without shoes in the dead of winter?"
Nick nodded.
"We did not make these tracks, Dad."
They'd put a throw rug over the bullet holes in the floor above the crawl space, and they both looked at it at the same time and for the same reason. It was now gone, and the floor was unmarked.
"Brooke, what about that little rug in the kitchen?
I put that horror back in the mudroom where it belongs, and leave it there, please. In the future, if you want to rearrange my house, submit your request in writing.
Dad, it was all real. It happened, and we're...
He stopped, frowned a little, shook his head. I lost it, he said. It was right on the tip of my tongue.
Wiley called Matt, but nobody had reported anybody strange wandering around in Harrow, or anywhere in Lautner County, for that matter.
What about the body in my crawl space? Is that resolved?
You want me to come out there with a net?
I thought you were going to arrest me.
There was a silence. Then,
oh yeah, you've got that absinthe, not to mention the cigar theft issue.
He had no memory whatsoever of Al North then. They talked then about the state of the pheasant population, which was excellent.
Matt wants to hunt tomorrow, Wiley called up to Nick. You game?
Nick looked at him.
He doesn't remember a thing, does he? You want to go or not?
Of course I do.
Wiley made plans to meet with Matt before dawn and go to some of the walk-in land over in Smith County.
You sure there's been nothing odd, Matt? No cars stolen around here, say?
In your neck of the woods, there hasn't been any crime of any kind over there at all, ever.
What the hell's the matter with you today, anyway? Is this some new insanity? I don't hunt with crazy people.
Read me the blotter for last night.
The blotter?
Look, it's not gonna kill you. Now read the damn thing.
Okay.
1632, Miss Wicks's chickens are in Elm Street again. Ticketed. 1805, car fire. Put out by occupant. 2022, kids smoking and playing loud music behind Wilson's Feed and Seed. Sent home.
That was it? That was what we paid you for last night?
We got a possible stolen truck. Jim Riggs can't find his farm banger, but it's probably going to be that Willie of his.
Hit it for a joke. That kid's got an unfortunate sense of humor.
So nothing strange had happened in this quiet little corner of Kansas for a long time, unless it was Samson who had gotten that truck, of course. Or no. There was one thing. The miserable accident that had befallen poor William Nunnally.
So, what's new in the Nunnally case?
Nothing. Coroner's report says it was exposure. He was high, it seems. Got a lot of meth heads down that way. Damnedest thing. The family's not going to sue you for some strange reason, going down there and terrorizing them like you did.
So it was just one of those things?
That would be true, crazy man.
The night passed uneventfully. Wiley and Nick got up at 4:30, and as the sun rose, they were hunting. True to form, Wiley over or undershot every rise he got, and all his pheasants lived to see another day. Nick, however, bagged Christmas dinner.
Epilogue. The Inheritors. New worlds are made in two places, the ruins of the old and the minds of the survivors. The captured souls had instantaneously returned to their wandering bodies, all but those of the dead, who had begun another kind of journey. Those who returned to life found themselves waking like sleepwalkers are known to do, in unaccustomed and impossible places. Lindy discovered herself riding in a jammed truck that was being driven by people who were equally mystified by where they were going and why. At the first town they came to, they stopped the truck. Everybody was thirsty and hungry, and many of them were hurt, mostly with injured feet, which Lindy certainly had. They pulled over in Laura, Colorado, which they found empty. There was no power. All phone lines were dead. Lindy remembered up until they had entered Third Street Methodist. The rest, she just had no idea. None at all. But she knew who she was and where she was from, and she also knew that she was going home. No matter what, she was returning to Harrow and to Martin and Trevor and her dear little Winnie.
This was far from impossible, as there were abandoned cars and trucks everywhere. She found a serviceable-looking hybrid that was full of gas. Her idea was that she was about 300 miles west of home, so the hybrid would get her there with gas to spare. She and some of the others from the truck gang, as they called themselves, broke into a place called the Laura Cafe. The milk was rotted, the eggs were higher than a kite, and there was no gas to cook with, so she contented herself with Cheerios washed down by water. They shared out the breakfast cereals, the cans of beans and soup, and took off in their various directions, all of them obsessed with the same thing, home. Lindy did not care to travel with anybody else. She wasn't sure what might happen. The world had collapsed. Then, for whatever unknown reason, her coffin nightmares had ended, and here she was. She had obviously been walking for miles and miles, but she had no memory of it at all. The car had a GPS, but it didn't manage to pick up any satellites, so she simply drove east on 70. Frequently, she had to go around abandoned vehicles, some of them in lines miles long, and travel cross-country in the bounding car. It held together, though, well enough, and soon she was heading into familiar little Harrow. There were people here and there, looking for the most part like they'd just come up after a tornado had passed, to see what was left. Winnie said, "I can come back." The voice was so clear that for a moment she thought that her daughter was sitting in the back seat. She shook her head. Seeing Third Street Methodist, she experienced a surge of terror so great that she had to stop the car right there in the middle of the street. "Mom?" She did not open her eyes. She'd lost her kids, her husband, everything. There was no more Winnie, and that voice had not been Trevor. Then the car door opened. She looked up into the smiling face of the most beautiful, most wonderful man in the world. She could not get out of the car. She tried, but she was shaking too hard. Her hands just went out and went clutching toward her Martin. And then his arms were coming. They were strong around her. They were taking her and lifting her, and she felt his lips upon her lips, and heaven came and lifted her. There were a thousand whispered words, but no words could express the meaning of this meeting. Her husband's and her son's eyes were strangely dark, and hers were, too, they told her. And they told her that this was good. It was a miracle. It was the future of mankind in their eyes, dark still, but there would be light. "What happened to us?" she asked as they drove out toward the smoke hills and home. "There was an earthquake," Martin said at last, "that affected the entire planet, and we're not out of the woods yet. But we're learning how to work in new ways, how to fix things." "A lot is wrong," Trevor said. Home was one of them, she soon discovered, and it was very wrong, so wrong that when she saw it, she burst into tears. "We can't clean this up," she wailed. She looked in disbelief at the melted, crazy furniture, at the twisted ruins of her kitchen. "What did this? This was no earthquake." 2012 came and went, Martin said at last. It turns out that the old Maya knew a lot. They calculated the return of, well, of evil, Trevor said simply. Evil was here, but it failed. He paused. And it had a good effect, because fighting it transformed us. I guess that's why you're supposed to love your enemy. He fell silent then, and in his silence, and with it, she could hear something that was a voice, and yet not a voice. It was more than a voice. She could hear engineers and physicists like herself and architects and workmen all gathered in a great chorus of plans and work and effort. "We're going to put the world back together again," she said. Martin said, "We've changed. The human mind is not the same, and a lot of people, the bad ones, I guess. Are they gone? Could they be gone?" They knew, then, that this terrible attack had also been a cleansing, because they could feel by its absence that the weight of wicked souls had been lifted. Lindy was the first to utter the words that had been on all of their lips unspoken from the moment they had found each other. "What about Winnie?" Martin shook his head. "We believe that she didn't make it." "What do you mean?" "Mom, you just need to let yourself happen. Don't think. Just be with us. Part of us." "My daughter is missing. Where's Bobby? Where are the state police, the FBI? The FBI gets involved in child disappearances. And what about our Jenny alert? Where's our Jenny alert?" He came to her, and she didn't want to do it, but she let him hold her, because she had spent what seemed like an eon trapped in that strange somewhere or other, trying to find him and to feel him where he ought to be and wasn't. "My baby's not bad. There's nothing wrong with her. She's hardly had a chance to live." She had to accept, but it wasn't going to be easy, because it was unfair that her dear little girl suffer the same fate as the wicked. It was just really, really unfair. Night fell, and Trevor made a place for himself on the floor of their little office, because his room was destroyed, and they did not want to disturb Winnie's room. It was cold, and without electricity it got dark early on the 22nd of December, and as it got dark, Lindy agonized over her lost child. But under their quilt that she had made when she was first married, it was wonderfully warm. They were dirty, though, and the warmth was ripening them. There was no water to wash, but that also did not prevent her from being Martin's wife again, and their bodies in the night were glad.
"Mommy?"
Lindy's eyes flew open. She cried out. Martin's hand caressed her cheek. "Sleep, my love." He came close and kissed her. "From hell to heaven," he murmured. Her whole heart, her blood, her soul took deepest joy in those words.
"Mommy?"
She leaped from the bed, ran to the window. "It's her!" Martin came to her, put his arms around her waist from behind. She pulled away from him. "Honey, shut up!"
"Hi, Mommy."
"Oh, baby, my baby, I hear you. Where are you?" Silence. "She's out there somewhere. Martin, she's out there and we have to find her. Martin, the Nighthawks." "Shh, there are no Nighthawks. They're gone." "How in hell do you know?" Martin tried again to hold her, but she pulled away. "Listen!" "Lindy, love." She was hurt. Everybody was hurt. So hurt. Then Trevor was there. "Listen to her, Dad." He turned around. Trevor came to them, nodded toward the window. Then Martin heard it, the ticking of an engine out in the dark. An electric surge of fear went through him. They had no gun. They still had no gun. Then he saw it, moving slowly closer to the house, a rattling old car with only the single light. "That's Bobby," he said. Then she was running. Lindy was running, and Martin, and behind them, Trevor. The car stood in the driveway, its engine guttering. Then the driver's door opened, and Martin saw in the light from within a tiny form, prim, in the passenger's seat. Lindy leaped at Bobby's car, threw the door open, and there was her little girl, who came out into her arms, and Lindy danced, whirling round and round with her child, silent in her arms, her child, smiling a soft smile. "Baby, baby, baby," Lindy cried, then cradled her and covered her with kisses. "Hi," Winnie said, and it echoed like a song in them all. "Buddy, she came in half an hour ago." Martin looked at him, embraced his old friend. "I thought you were a goner for sure. I thought you were." He looked at Lindy and Winnie. "I don't know how to tell you this, or even exactly what I am telling you." "I know she's dead," Martin said. "I saw her body."
"Daddy,
it's all changed." Winnie and Trevor's thoughts echoed as one. He had a son who could read minds, now a daughter returned from the dead. They took her inside, loving her, touching her. And she was full and normal flesh in every way. Bobby lingered. "Boy, they did a number around here." "Oh, yes." "I don't know quite what happened, but I know you were a big part of it. I can hear people thinking about what happened, and a lot of them are thinking about you, Martin." "We can all hear each other," Trevor said in their minds. "Gonna be interesting times for cops," Bobby thought. He glanced around, then laughed a little. He took Martin aside. "She isn't the same," he whispered.
"I'm all different," Winnie added. "Then, this house is a mess."
Lindy threw a picture of the glaring reptilian features of Maisel into their minds. "Did it." Winnie reached into the air, and her old friend Barish came flopping into her hands. He was soaked and crusted with ice and mud.
"You got lost."
As she moved through the house, everything she touched came back to its previous condition. She opened the fridge.
"We still have to go to the store."
Then, in words,
"Except for these apples. I didn't steal them. They were grounded."
She brought out 5 small apples. They were cold, a little old, obviously falls. Martin was famished. They all were, and they ate silently. He wondered where they'd come from, and saw in his mind a picture of the Wright's apple tree, its fruit all fallen. She came and hugged his legs. He lifted her and thought that she was not quite as heavy as she had been, not quite as solid. He knew that he held a miracle in his arms, and that there must be millions of such miracles over all the earth right now. He kissed his miracle and she laughed, and he thought he was holding the promise of the whole future in his arms.
"You are,"
Trevor said as he crunched into his apple. The little family was taking a journey into a new world, and this journey was being repeated all across the planet as a new mankind rose up from the ruins of the old, and the risen and the living joined together in a new chorus, and the long ages of illusion that there is a curtain between the living and the dead were ended. The undiscovered country had been discovered, and the explorers were returning. Winnie settled into the deep comfort of her father's arms. Bobby reached out and touched her, and she felt the energy in him that was a little sharp in places and smoothed it out. Tears came to his eyes. He stared at her, drank her in. She let him clutch her. She laughed. She had been on such a long journey. "You smell like roses," he whispered. She ate her apple, thinking of what life is, what it really is. She thought of her old body, still lying where it had fallen, giving itself back to dust and memory.
"Life is the mystery of the world," she told them.
The minds around her fell silent. Death had ended. They just didn't know it yet. She understood what had really been done here and who had done it, and the real reason, that only the good remained, because only the good could find the next secret, the true meaning of life without death. Over time, she would tell them everything, that there was a new humanity born and a whole new way of living to be discovered, but now she laid her very tired head against her daddy's shoulder. She would sleep on this night, the sweetest of all sleeps, deep in her home, surrounded by her family, at one with their love and all love, in a world that had been saved. A little while, and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. But the meek will inherit the earth and enjoy great peace. Psalm 37, 10-11. This concludes the reading of 2012, The War for Souls, by Whitley Strieber. Copyright 2007 by Whitley Strieber. This book was read by Joe Barrett. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Scoville Chichak Galen Literary Agency Incorporated and was produced in 2007 by Blackstone Audio Incorporated, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Incorporated. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.